This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, also online at will.uiuc.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. What shall we have to eat? For most Americans, there are so many choices. We can open the refrigerator and cupboard and whip something up. If we don't have on hand what we need to make that dinner, well, the supermarket is just a few minutes away. We could make a reservation at a swank restaurant. We could head out to one of the many chain restaurants that dot the landscape. Or we could choose carry out or drive through. How did we come to have so many choices, such abundance? It's a relatively recent development. For most of humankind's history, we made a living by hunting and gathering. So, what's our topic this afternoon? Food globalization. Our guest is Kenneth Kuipil. He is distinguished university professor at Bowling Green State University. He is the author of A Movable Feast, 10 Millennia of Food Globalization. The book is based on a book our guest edited, The Cambridge World History of Food, which was nominated in 2001 for the James Beard Foundation Cookbook Awards. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Kenneth Kuipil. You can join us with a telephone call this afternoon. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. A Movable Feast, 10 Millennia of Food Globalization is published by Cambridge University Press. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor Kuipil, good afternoon. Welcome back to the program.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you.
It's so nice to have you back with us. How recent a development is all this abundance, all this choice?
Well, it was a gradual process after the invention of agriculture about 10 or 11,000 years ago. it was a situation where rice from China and barley and wheat from the Middle East and got together, and citrus fruits moved from East Asia or Southeast Asia into Europe, and as I said, it was all kind of gradual for a while. Things that kind of speeded up the process were the Silk Road, which connected the Roman Empire to China. And then the big one was, of course, the, what do we want to say, discovery of the New World? But anyway, 1492 and its aftermath and the scattering about then of all kinds of foodstuffs.
Yeah. Well, I guess we could say it was the discovery of Europeans of the Americas, because there were people living here. There were great civilizations before the Europeans arrived.
That's right.
On the continent of North America and the continent of South America. And, you know, that brings me, you know, that kind of a political issue brings me to, you know, the word globalization. It can lead us to heated discussion. To say the least. When you use that term, food globalization, what do you mean?
Well, I don't mean McDonaldization or Coca-Colaization, although, of course, that's what makes news. But what I mean is it's a process that's been going on for 10,000 years, when the first wild wheat was brought into cultivation in one place, and barley in another, and maize in another. And since the domesticated jungle fowl of Southeast Asia headed west to become the European chicken. And wild boars domesticated in the Middle East, pushed east to Indonesia to become pigs somewhere along the line, before sailing away with the human pioneers who spread out in the Pacific. In other words, this process I was talking about, which leads us to today, where if you have the money, you can have any food in the world within, particularly because of the internet, within a very short period of time.
Yeah, and it was certainly not always so. In the book, A Movable Feast, one of the fascinating chapters is delves into spices, salt and pepper and herbs and spices and the like. And it used to be once upon a time that pepper was only for the very wealthiest folks. And there was a fellow back in the 15th century, Carl the Duke of Bourgogne. He ordered 380 pounds of pepper for his wedding.
Yes. He was the wealthiest man in Europe, and probably the only one that could afford that kind of extravagance. Pepper was worth, at that time, more than gold in terms of weight. And people would leave it in their wills and to their heirs, and people ordered it, and certainly used it as a currency. And as a matter of fact, when the so-called barbarians captured Rome, Rome was ransomed, and part of the ransom was 3,000 pounds of pepper.
Hmm. Now, at Carl, the Duke of Bourgogne, at his wedding, would peppercorns have been on display as a sign of wealth, or would have been sprinkled on food, or both, or what did people do with pepper back in the 15th century?
Well, they used it to enliven their food. Food was pretty, what do I want to say, bland, and those that could afford to take away some of that blandness did so, and pepper was probably the leading choice.
Hmm. Were spices other than pepper used as currency?
Sure. As a matter of fact, most all of them were ginger and cloves and almost anything that came from the Spice Islands. And and the poor, I always think this is kind of interesting, because the poor who couldn't afford any of this had to make do with local spices, and some of those are still in use today, like sage and oregano. And so many of these that were kind of weeds, but made use of by people that couldn't afford anything else.
Yeah. Well, I don't think of the sage in my yard as a weed. I love it, and the oregano as well, in my herb garden. What about chocolate? Tell us this a little bit of the story of chocolate and how it came to move across the globe.
Well, let's see. Cacao nibs are little beans were noticed right away by the Spanish who invaded Mexico because the nibs were used as currency. And of course, if something was used as money, then the conquerors wanted a piece of the action. And as a matter of fact, Hernando Cortes bought up an awful lot of the cacao. They introduced it to Europe, and it took a while to really catch on, because Europe didn't have sugar to speak of then, and it needed a sweetener, honey, or something to
make it palatable.
Just raw sugar, or not raw chocolate. This baker's chocolate, for example, is pretty bitter. So it took a while, but it did catch on with the addition of sugar. And as a matter of fact, sugar and cacao and coffee and the growth of consumption of coffee and tea kind of all go together, and that's what makes the sugar industry very big news from about the 17th century on. The chocolate was marketed in kind of chocolate shops, and it never caught on as well as tea and coffee. mostly for by royalty. I've never really got into the cuisine of the commoners. But but then, of course, chocolate was all of a sudden discovered by confection makers, and that put a new lease on chocolate life. It's still with us today.
Yeah. When did people realize that corn could be used to make things sweet?
Well, that's a fairly recent development. Corn syrup. Maize, of course, was around for a long time here in the Americas. And as a matter of fact, by the time the Europeans got here, for me this is amazing because they bred maize so that it could grow in high altitudes along the coast. They had over 200 different kinds of maize, and yet, to my knowledge, the use of corn as a sweetener is a mid-20th century phenomenon.
Yeah. Did the domestication of crops precede the domestication of animals, or was it the other way around, or did the two happen rather simultaneously?
Yeah, that's a good question that food historians wrestle with to this day. I think that all this happened at the end of the last big ice age, and all of a sudden the climate changed, and large animals that had been feeding everybody kind of receded. The caribou went north, and for those that stayed behind, they began then to plant crops. In other words, they began to, first of all, harvest wild wheat and barley, and then learned how to make it grow where they wanted to rather than go to the stands of these wild grains. And I think that what happened here is that there was certainly a good amount of garden hunting. In other words, it was protecting the gardens, but here would come goats and sheep in particular to nibble on the crops. And so they were captured, killed, and yet they probably weren't used all that much as food. I know a strange concept, but most all the domesticated animals were domesticated because they could be used for sacrifice. And that was the kind of crop insurance. Here were these people investing all of their enormous energies in a single crop and working from dawn to dusk. And if that crop failed, they were in big trouble. And so the idea was to sacrifice animals to the gods, and then it became a situation where they began to notice that there were other products here they could utilize, like meat and hides and eggs and wool and so on and so forth. But these were later developments. I think the domestication of animals came then, to answer your question, second, after the domestication of plants. And it came not as because of a recognition of the things that these animals could provide, but rather because the, well, it was kind of crop insurance, I guess, the sacrificing. I think one only has to look at the aurochs. That's the ancestor of our cattle. And, of course, our cattle today are kind of benign, gentle, docile creatures, but their ancestor was far from it. He stood at the shoulder, he was over 6 feet in height, and he was absolutely ferocious. He weighed way over 2,200 pounds, and the To look at a picture, when they died out in about the 18th century, became completely extinct. But to look at a picture, when, I mean, they make a Spanish fighting bull look like a kind of a cream puff. And if you could imagine, thinking about domesticating this animal, it had to have been for sacrifice, because you could not have looked at that animal and anyway envisioned the kind of docile creatures that we have today.
Yeah. Wouldn't want to run with those bulls.
Nope.
No. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Kenneth Kuipil, author most recently of A Movable Feast, 10 Millennia of Food Globalization. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. What role did the dog play, the domestication of the dog play, in the domestication of other animals?
Well, the dog came first. In other words, it was domesticated while people were still hunting and gathering, about 16,000 B.C., whereas the domestication of the rest of the animals happened somewhere around 10,000 to maybe 8,000 B.C. And the domestication of the dog all by itself is kind of an interesting development. It's one of those things where hunters and gatherers must have appreciated the hunting ability of the wolf and somehow transformed the wolves into dogs. But that had to have been a tough process. We've got evidence, skeletal evidence indicated that sometimes the dog wound up as dinner, for the hunter gatherers, and sometimes the hunter gatherers wound up as dinner for the dog. Yet it was this combination of dog and human that really increased the efficiency of hunting, and in the process, animals started to become extinct, particularly the large ones, and then the dog was used, I guess, in the domestication of other animals as a herder and so on and so forth, keep in mind. But that would have been sheep and goats, but that came, as I say, much later.
Where were these wolves and people when they first got together?
Apparently, this was the Middle East. In other words, the same place that in the Taurus Mountains there, the same place that animal domestication began later on. Hmm. Although it was certainly, that's the one we know most about, and we have the most skeletal evidence of, but certainly it happened other places as well. In other words, it was kind of a multiple domestication that happened in Russia and probably in the lake area of Switzerland and probably in England as well.
Hmm. So folks maybe were around the world were getting the same idea about the same time?
Yeah. And diffusion is one of those unfathomable, because you can't unravel it all, but certainly one of the forces that was at work in early globalization.
Hmm. Back to the idea of beginning the taming of animals and the domestication of animals for use as sacrificial animals. How else have religious beliefs shaped agriculture?
Well, certainly in that way. In other words, one doesn't know. But if they're sacrificing animals, and apparently they were in large numbers to ensure good crops, then they had to have had a religious organization. In other words, somebody was a priest of sorts, and probably more than one. And as villages developed, then more organized religion developed, so that by the time we get to civilizations in the Middle East like Ur, we have priests running the show. In other words, they're the ones that allotted land. They're the ones who kept track of the agricultural production. And as a matter of fact, they had to then have writing in order to do it, and so they invented writing. And all kind of exciting, even if we can't yet piece it all together.
Yeah. And also, it's interesting to think of the recommendations that priests or rabbis or whoever the religious leaders were, what they said to do and what they said was forbidden. And this included things like some people, meat was forbidden. And another things, there were ways to prescribe to how to prepare foods and how to preserve them as well.
Sure. As a matter of fact, it was the Jewish faith and the rabbis that first began to make food prohibitions. And then, of course, the Muslims came along quite a bit later and did the same thing. Kind of interesting with Christianity, although certainly the church fathers were obsessed with food. In other words, the Last Supper and the fast days or fasting days, and so on and so forth. There were no real prohibitions on individual food items, but certainly by the time they finished with their fasting days, they had pretty close to half of the days of the year where you couldn't eat meat, and that certainly gave rise to the fishing industry and made it a really big business.
Hmm. It's interesting to learn that some of the crops that we prize today were probably accidentally cultivated. Would you tell us about that? Legumes are one example of that.
Sure. Well, I guess a classic example is the banana. There are so many things about a banana tree that are valuable. You thatch a roof with it. You use the fibers for rope making, and so the banana trees, if you will, they're actually a giant herb, were cultivated for a long time without any, and the fruit, of course, would have developed very, very slowly. But ultimately, I guess it must have, because according to legend anyway, in Southeast Asia, the people began to realize they could eat bananas when they saw birds doing it. Another good example is the squash. These were cultivated for a long time, not for what was inside. Not for food, but rather to be used as utensils for drinking and food storage and that kind of thing. And only later after a long time of domestication and cultivation, did the squash or pumpkins or any of those groups develop the flesh and the seeds that, and I'm sure it was the seeds that were used next, and only last was the flesh made palatable enough to eat.
Yeah, and the banana, the early banana, was apparently not very palatable.
No, yet with continued cultivation, it became so.
Yes, today it is so sweet.
Right.
Yeah. When did people begin to preserve foods, and how did they do it?
Probably salt was the first thing that they used, and they would have used salt because in salt marshes, they spied animals that were really well preserved in the salt bogs, and salt, of course, gets rid of the moisture so that something doesn't rot. So probably salting and the combination of salting and drying was the first technique, or the first techniques that were used. And smoking would have come sometime after that.
And fermentation?
I'm sorry?
Fermentation?
Yeah. Fermentation was certainly another important way. They had to this came with the production of wine, and with the production of wine also came the production of vinegar. And that was not another food preservative, right?
Yeah. When did people begin to ferment things so that they would have a little kick to them? I'm thinking here of, you know, wines, spirits, beer.
Yeah, well, wine was probably first, although maybe not, because beer, any place that you made bread, you had a yeasty environment, and certainly beer, probably beer and bread almost went hand in hand. Now there is a scholar who argues that before anything, beer was invented, and then this is the reason that our ancestors began to plant grain so that they could make beer. In other words, beer was according to him, the fountain of agriculture. Beer certainly developed in the Middle East, but right after that, it was in Egypt, and wine developed the same place, ironically, because of course now that area doesn't tolerate any kind of alcoholic beverage, but wine would have developed there too, and then spread out from there.
Yeah. When foods cross cultural borders, what happens? Are they adopted? Are they adapted? Are they rejected? How is it that we have such a variety today? I mean, we've done a little bit of everything here, haven't we? We've said, we're not going there, and we've said, well, this is great, let's just take this on right now, and then we've tinkered with a lot of things as well.
Sure, your listing of rejection and so on and so forth, I would answer all of the above, because it's kind of interesting to follow American foods in Europe. Because at first, nobody was particularly interested in anything for two or three reasons. One, they weren't mentioned in the Bible. And if they weren't mentioned in the Bible, then there had to have been something wrong with them. Second of all, many of them belonged to a family that the deadly nightshade belonged to.
Mm.
And in other words, and I'm talking about potatoes and
tomatoes
in particular. And so that certainly had a retarding effect, although the Europeans also knew that the eggplant belonged to that family, and they were eating eggplants. That was not a New World food. But then ultimately they did. The tomato probably caught on first among the peasants of Spain and then Italy. Potatoes were really tough because they also somewhere along the line acquired a reputation for causing leprosy, And yet the potatoes were planted first of all as a famine crop, in other words, a just in case crop. But then there were enough famines that people were forced to eat potatoes whether they wanted to or not, and they were also forced to plant them, particularly in Germany. And in France, they were kind of tricked into it by an interesting psychological trick pulled on them by a member of the court, and he planted them and put a guard around them. And, peasants all kept an eye on this, and so they thought they had to be valuable, and then they removed the guard, and the peasants ran in and stole everything they could, took it home and planted them. And the potato was ultimately adopted.
Yeah.
Maize was the one crop that had more difficulty. Sweet potatoes were the easiest. Then white potatoes were more difficult, and maize never did really get developed, get adopted, except in that area, that belt that runs across from northern Spain through northern Italy and into the Balkans. And there people were just so poor that they'd eat anything. And that's where, of course, the pellagra developed too, which comes from a disease that comes from diet too closely concentrated on maize.
Maybe you would tell us a little bit about the story of the soybean, because that is now the most widely consumed plant in the world.
That's right. And we didn't in the West have much to do with the development of the soybean. That was developed a long time ago and then spread about by Buddhist monks. Who were vegetarian and used soybean, used a kind of tofu for a meat substitute. When the monks then went from China to Japan and Korea, they took the soybean with them. And as I say, spread it about. The soybean didn't get to the U.S. Well, it got here with Perry, who had opened up Japan in the before the Civil War. And by opened up, I mean Japan had been closed to foreign countries for a long time. But Perry showed up with the necessary firepower to open the place up. He brought back soybeans. They were planted and pretty well ignored as a crop. Then I think somebody on the Perry expedition went to Savannah, Georgia, or Charleston, one of the two, and he planted soybeans there, and thought he was going to make a fortune. But the trouble was that there was just nothing about soybeans that fit into the diet. Finally, soybeans got to be important in this country after, our major oil at the end of the 19th century was cottonseed oil. But the problem was, with cottonseed oil, it had a bad taste. A chemist named Wesson was the guy that got rid of the taste, and it became Wesson oil then. But then the boll weevil messed up the cotton production, and gradually soybeans began to be used, and then although we were an oil importing country until after the Second World War, we became the world's biggest oil exporter with the full scale development of soybeans, and certainly farmers learned that soybeans do fix nitrogen in the soil, so they're a really good crop for rotation with, say, corn, and that's of course what they do throughout the Midwest today.
Yeah. Right here, we're sitting right in the smack dab middle of it. Those Buddhist monks way back when, how was it that they knew that the soybean packed such a nutritional wallop?
Well, I don't know that they did for sure. But you're right about that nutritional wallop. The soybean is the only vegetable food. I think. Now, there may be another one I just read about. But the soybean, until very recently, was the only known vegetable food to have all the essential amino acids. In other words, to have the same kind of protein that you'd get from eating meat or drinking milk or from eggs. Now, I don't know whether they knew this or not, but actually, probably the most healthy thing they could eat, since vegetables were the food for the millions in the Far East. And as a matter of fact, there was very little protein in the diet anyway.
Mm. Also, soybeans are something that you can pretty easily carry around and preserve and.
Yeah, sure, and then plant, and that's what they did. It was all the same Buddhist monks that also took tea with them, so they were certainly a force in early globalization.
Yeah, there's a part of your book that deals with restaurants. And I think before we run out of time, I think this would be fun to talk about. What role has the restaurant played in the globalization of food?
Well, I argue a couple of things. First of all, that the U.S. leads the world in food globalization, largely because we didn't have any other cuisine except what came from abroad. In other words, we had the Massachusetts cuisine. We had a Southern food cuisine. We had a French cuisine of sorts in Louisiana, so on and so forth. But it all came from abroad. So we were perhaps more prepared than anybody else to adopt new foods. On the other hand, those new foods had to be introduced, and as a rule, they were introduced through the restaurants. And of course, the restaurant chapter was a lot of fun to kind of research.
It's interesting to know that the Chinese restaurant has been an American staple going back quite a while.
Yeah, going back to the Transcontinental Railroad. And the Chinese workers that came east in building it. It was, of course, Italians that were going the other direction and wound up in California and running the wine industry eventually. But the Chinese who kind of dropped off here and there and opened Chinese restaurants and they made as you say, they made Chinese food a staple in the U.S.
Yeah, by 1880, virtually every major American city had a Chinese restaurant.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, when did the cookbook appear?
Well,
because I would think that would have a
role. The first cookbook that we know about was penned by Apicius, a Roman, and he Apicius is a nickname that the Romans gave to anybody who was a gourmet. But we know about this fellow in particular because he did write a cookbook, and that's our big insight into what the Romans ate back during the days of their empire. From there, the cookbook is kind of hard to trace. Certainly, by the 19th century, there are quite a few in England, and then we got one or two over here. End of the 18th century, and as I say, it's kind of difficult to trace. In Ann Arbor, Michigan, at the library there, they've got a whole big cookbook collection I've always wanted to go have a look at, but never have had the chance to.
Yeah. It seems to me today we have a fascination with cookbooks. I mean, going to the library or a bookstore, and it's just a huge area of those buildings. Why do you suppose that is? Do you have any insight into our fascination with cookbooks?
Well, not really. I mean, everybody buys the can, buys a fancy refrigerator and stove, and
then they go out to eat.
Yeah, and I'm not at all sure it's not the same thing with cookbooks. I guess that you know the answer has to be that it's globalization and people are really interested in different kinds of. Different kind of foods and different kind of cooking techniques, and so they may go out to eat, and then we'll look up the recipe afterwards at home. And I would guess that with the internet, that's not going to last. In other words, my gosh, you can get almost anything on the on the internet that you you can get in a cookbook with a lot less cost.
Yeah, all you have to do is Google or
right.
Put it into your browser and you're there, and there are food sites, you know, food sites associated with cooking magazines and cooking television
right.
Programs.
I've got Epicurious, collects all this stuff, and they send me something about every other day.
Yeah. And then the television network, the cable network, has a site.
Sure, that's so it's certainly a different world from when I was first growing up. I mean, it was the comfort foods, or what we call comfort foods now.
Yeah.
Nobody used garlic, for gosh sakes, and only winos drank wine. It's a different world.
Yeah, I think my mother used about three or four spices. You know, that was it, and it was that they were never fresh. You know, so and the grocery store was a whole different experience when I was a kid, compared to today. Well, it's a fascinating topic, and I want to thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
Sure, well, I'm happy to.
Kenneth Kuipel has been our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine. He's the author of A Movable Feast, 10 Millennia of Food Globalization, the publisher, Cambridge University Press.